I imagine so.
Not pleasant.
Not pleasant when you get up for your cup of coffee and all the dirty dishes just sitting there with a pair of pink underwear floating in them.
I haven't had that experience.
Maybe you haven't lived with enough women.
I haven't been to whorehouses in Thailand either.
That's a good point. And I've never been skiing, so I guess we're even. Welcome to the Futile Podcast. If you want to check our website out, www.graniteseed.com/futilepodcast, you can go and you can enter the Futile Contest, where if you want to come up with a caption for my for the photograph up there that we've got, you can email that to futilepodcast@gmail.com. But today, a little sad, a little bittersweet. All good things must come to an end. We got Callahan 5, the Deadpool. Mark, what do you want to say? Callahan 5.
Callahan 5, the Deadpool. One of the Oscar beginnings for James Carey.
Correct.
Apparently Axl must have bitched out.
Axl must have bitched out because they used the actual Guns N' Roses music and Slash was in it and stuff. Slash was in it twice.
Well, it looked like... three of the band members.
They had, so it seems like they maybe were working something out with Guns N' Roses. This is 1988, so Appetite was well into its own.
That came out in 87?
I think 87 or 86. Yeah, 88. Damn. So what are we working at here? We're 3 years away. No, we're 17 years.
Yep.
Wow. 17 years. Callahan's looking it. He's old.
He seems to be staying in shape.
Yeah, he's definitely. They've emphasized that more in this one than any of the other ones. So they have him jogging, and they have him in the weight room.
Well, you know what's funny is he's a lot beefier.
Yeah, he doesn't look as much as like a lean like cop. That's true. It starts a lot in the same way as the first one, with cityscape of San Francisco at night, and kind of this. It's the same guy doing the soundtrack that did the fourth one. So it's very similar to the fourth one in its beginning. And it, even in its look to a degree, not really aesthetically, because it's not directed by Eastwood. It's a little more generically directed, a little more of an 80s-looking movie. It's got, like, this shiny sheen quality that a lot of 80s action movies have, you know? It's overlit, like a lot of 80s movies were. It's a lot of powerful, strong lights and stuff. I mean, that could be sort of a weird homage to the fact that it's talking about the film industry in it, because this guy's this slasher movie maker is sort of... one of the main antagonists of the story.
You know, I was just played thinking by about Liam that, Neeson. How that's definitely, like, I was thinking about the 70s and very soft lighting, and then you get into, like, the Tim Burton in the late 80s, early 90s, and everything's very dark. And
well, it's dark, but it's also, I mean, in the 80s action stuff, you got, like, movies like all the George P. Cosmatos stuff, you know, like Leviathan and Tango and Cash and stuff, they've all got this almost like blue shininess. Like someone took like a high key like 5K light and bounced it off a piece of blue opalescent metal and is using the reflection on that off of that to do like fill lighting or something.
Well, maybe you can. I was assuming that it was some sort of improvement in film.
Well, there's different stocks probably, and you got a greater variety obviously in 1988 than you do in 1971. That said, I will say that from a purely aesthetic standpoint, the Callahan movies from the 70s, I greatly prefer. Just something about the way San Francisco looked in the 70s and the way that they shot it in those first three movies, I like a lot more than I did in this movie and I did in the fourth movie. And that's just from the aesthetic standpoint. I'm just judging it purely off of that. I think for some big, you know, for Leviathan, for Tango and Cash, that big 80s overlit, for Die Hard, that works. I like that look in those movies.
I don't remember Die Hard being overlit.
It's got some pretty sharp, intense moments. It's got this like 80s, overlit isn't, maybe it's maybe the wrong terminology. So back to Callahan. This story is...
Should ask Dr. Drew what it means.
We should. This story is basically the more exciting Callahan story happened between 4 and 5, which was where he brings down this mafioso guy. What was his name? Gennaro?
Yep.
He brings down this Gennaro guy, and basically there's a price on his head because of it. And so a lot of, like, big 80s action set pieces end up happening, where guys are shooting Uzis at him and blow up his car.
A lot of Uzis.
And he inexplicably survives. And, I mean, this is where the camp factor, like you said, is definitely there. I don't know,
as oddly as it sounds, it's not easy.
I know.
To hit somebody with a little submachine gun.
Twice they've basically got him in a confined space, you know, in his car.
But it's Callahan.
Exactly, it's Callahan. And at that point, he's become mythical. And they've recognized that in the movie. So it's kind of a meta-commentary on Callahan where they're talking about, you're like the super cop Callahan, and they want to do cover story articles about you, and, you know, the police, one of the guys wants to use him as a PR tool, and Callahan's not having any of that.
You know, and that's kind of the funny thing. They finally gave up on giving him shit about changing and being a dinosaur and
crap. This one wasn't about that, which was kind of inappropriate, considering it was the last. Now, maybe they didn't know it was going to be the last, and who knows, you know, they always sort of, the next one comes around. But this one does not have the...
I would have watched the sixth one.
Sure, no problem.
You know, and this is something I wanted to point out, too, with sequels. They got campier, but they didn't try to... Like, I always felt each one took itself less seriously than the last one had.
To a degree. I think the first three are... I think the first three Callahan movies are pretty solidly connected. I mean, they're only a couple years apart, and they got the same visual aesthetic and the same sort of mentality, and it's the same era, I guess. Things haven't changed. There's such a major change between the third and the fourth, just time-wise and culture-wise and film stock-wise. I mean, like, all kinds of stuff has just changed. It's now the 80s,
you
know? It's
not like the fourth one had, you know, like, the Sex Pistols.
No. But it was just, like, it had, like, the synths in the soundtrack, even.
I figured you dig the synths.
I do, to a degree. But it's a different kind of movie. It's, like I said, this one starts and it feels like I'm watching The Equalizer, which I love. I love The Equalizer. It's a great show.
Well, you know, Callahan...
He's busy equalizing.
Callahan is just progressing along with the rest of San Francisco to a certain extent.
But really, it's like, I guess...
Post-milked.
The story, yeah, definitely. The story here is a good story, though. It's an interesting story because it's talking about the whole violence and corruption in the media and the sort of bloodlust of the media. And it's an issue that they bring up and they deal with when the guy tries to light himself on fire. And there's kind of a moral here though it doesn't really connect to the ultimate sort of action and plot, which is really just that at the end, it's just some crazy guy. It's really just out of nowhere some crazy guy, which is similar, I guess, to the first one, except the first one, you kind of knew that the crazy guy was doing what he was doing, and so there was more of a...
He just wanted to taste the sounds.
There was more of a cat and mouse thing, yeah. Well,
I think
he wanted to see the colors or whatever, right? The crazy guy.
Saw the colors, everything would have been all
right. That's right.
He could hear the colors, and he could taste the sound.
So I don't know.
That's a problem.
The thing is, the movie is commenting on...
Especially when you're not...
I guess sort of the decay of society into this bloodlust and these horror films and torture porn type stuff.
Because Scorpio was...
Yeah. Was so calm and peaceful, right? But
he was.
But the thing is that then they bring in this whole mentally ill guy as the bane, all of a sudden at the end, in the last 10 minutes, literally, becomes the bad guy. And,
well, I mean, you can tell that it's not Peter Swan.
To a degree, I don't know. I kept thinking, were they just being really terrible about, like, their reveal? Or was it that...
You haven't even brought up Liam Neeson.
Yeah, no, I mentioned that he was this director that, you know, was making these movies.
What did you feel about his portrayal as a director?
He portrayed a full-of-himself, rat-tail, 80s camp, crappy horror movie director just fine, you know? He was full of himself, and he made schlock, and he knew it, and, you know...
You wouldn't like, put somebody like Wes Craven in that category, would you?
Nah, with him and John...
I don't know if you've ever listened to him speak.
With him and John Carpenter, it's a little different because, I mean, like, Carpenter did...
Listen to either one of them is awesome.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I love listening to him.
Yeah, no, they're pretty cool guys. I don't know if... I don't think he was trying to... They were specifically referencing either one of those guys.
Well, I don't think either one of them have exclusively done... Well, I know John Carpenter hasn't, but I believe, yeah, Wes Craven, I don't think they've exclusively either one of them directed horror films.
So yeah, this commentary on violence and horror slasher movies, which, I mean, you know, you were at Jason, I don't know which Jason you were at.
A little bit of that in this with the knifing.
Oh yeah, no, yeah, yeah, there is. They're kind of doing it all and talking about it. And I mean, like, I think where I start to have a couple little bits of problems with the film is that it's basically whatever it's trying to sort of soapbox criticize, it's a little preachy about to some degree, like the part where the guy's going to light himself on fire, but then it still shows the guy light himself on fire. It's still kind of capitalized. And I almost feel like it would have been a better scene if that had not happened. If the guy had not been lit on fire. And if it had been like a total anticlimactic feeling, because us as an audience would want to see the guy lit on fire. Just like the people there watching it, just like... And then when the woman, you know, the reporter, Patricia Clarkson, says, I'm not going to shoot you, commit suicide, and we're not going to film this, it would have been like everyone would have to feel that letdown. And
I'm
the audience
not even exactly too, sure.
From the bloodlust, you know?
I'm not even exactly sure if they would let you air that.
Yeah, I don't know if it was live.
I think
whatever.
The FCC would have a problem with that.
That's true.
Because usually, you know, maybe they'll have a clip or two really brief.
Avert your eyes, that kind of stuff.
Avert your eyes kind of shit.
I mean, this
You know, I think there was a big, that crap in, like, Scrooged with the old lady dying because mm-hmm. of the promo, and I think there must have been, like, an instant or two of that, like, violence on TV.
Probably,
or something.
Yeah. I mean,
this
was the 80s. The violence was really finally coming into its own in the 80s.
It really was. It was awesome time.
It was a good time for us to be kids growing up.
It was.
And then we go out and do that to bums on the weekends, right? High five. Red Ice. So, I mean, I just...
Yeah,
I,
we were in... go ahead.
I just wonder... I feel like I liked this one a little better than the fourth one, but I...
You just hate Sandra Locke, don't you?
No, I like Patricia Clarkson. She seemed cool. Anyway, so in this Callahan, he's got an Asian partner because the PR guy thinks it would be good for him to have a Chinese-American... partner, and he does some kung fu action on one of the perps when Callahan goes into a Fortune 500 company. He goes into a Fortune Cookie 500 company, and he reads off the fortune to Anthony Michael Hall, who's in there trying to rob it.
Was that
no, it just looked like him, kind of. Okay.
Well, at that period of time, I can't always catch him. He looks. So
that's where you get. That's where you get the catchphrase for this one, which is like, "You're shit out of luck." Shit out of luck, and he plugs him in the gut, in the belly. He only uses it one other time, and that's at the end when he gives the harpoon gun to the crazy mentally ill guy. Poor mentally ill guy. Honestly, you gotta wonder, like, was that a justified righteous kill on Callahan's part at that point? Or did the guy just need, like, some meds and to be taken care of, and maybe to be put into the state hospital? The system had failed that guy, yeah. It was Callahan's turn. I hate the goddamn system.
You know, that's true. That was pretty with the harpoon gun.
Yeah. It was really stupid. But funny.
But he'd cut up his woman. And
A little bit. He kind of scratched her neck, yeah.
That was... Oh, Jesus.
Let's talk about the car chase. Because that was unique car chase where you've got the guy with the little... I guess they're gas-powered remote-controlled cars. Because those things were hauling ass.
Oh yeah, it was an actual little tiny two-stroke single-cylinder engine,
which they must have referenced later in Batman the Animated Series in the Grey Ghost episode, because in the Grey Ghost episode of Batman the Animated Series, it was all about how this guy was putting explosives on little remote control cars and driving them into buildings to blow them up for Roland Daggett, because Roland Daggett was then owner of, like, the property, but he needed to evict the he was like a slumlord, but he wanted to get the people out of the slum so that way he could, you know, develop, like in Batteries Not Included. Remember Batteries Not Included?
I remember that. Wasn't Wilford Brimley in that?
I don't think so. He was in Cocoon.
Jessica Tandy?
I think you're thinking of Cocoon, dude.
No, it was some of the same fucking people.
I think maybe Jessica Tandy was in it. I don't think Wilford Brimley was. Some but different old, Don Amici was, I think.
Don Amici, that's what it was.
That's what it was. Okay. But yeah.
Was Steve was the Goop Man?
No, he wasn't. Somebody else played his version, his character in that. But this was interesting because it was basically like Callahan gets in a car chase, but he's running away from this remote control car. And so you get the obligatory San Francisco car jumps and stuff. And then in the end, they catch up to him, blow him up, but it doesn't kill him.
It came close.
It was kind of a weird conclusion to an odd car chase. And so, like, you know, like I do, when there's a unique chase sequence, like with Running Scared or something, then I got to give it extra plus points there. So I definitely got to give Deadpool some points for having...
That is pretty cool.
Having a chase with a remote control car. Okay, let's just do this. Let's hammer out the last
game. Okay, fine.
So
your shtick with it was just funnier than hell with that shit though.
Oh, thank you, I appreciate it.
That's okay.
We'll talk about it off mic. We don't want to be tooting our own horn on mic.
No.
So yeah, I just am lamenting that they never did a sixth because I feel like with a little bit of breathing room, maybe post Unforgiven. He could, and post all the Oscar buzz and everything, he could have come back himself and really just hit it out of the park with like a Peckinpah-esque final days of Harry Callahan on the streets kind of thing.
That would have been bizarre.
In a new, I mean, because in the new San Francisco of the mid-90s, you know. No, I gotta give Callahan 5 a 3. I liked it a little better than the fourth one, probably because it felt a little more like a Callahan movie. It stuck to San Francisco.
I thought that you would.
It had more with the partner, which I always liked the dynamic with the partner, except in the fourth one I felt like the Horace was just not there enough. They almost never did any cop stuff together. They didn't at all, I don't think.
They didn't have time because they had to give it all to Sandra Locke.
Yeah, exactly. And
because they had a side story.
And the side story, I didn't appreciate. It wasn't a Callahan movie. It was to a degree.
I still appreciated Mick.
Oh, yeah. I appreciated a lot of the Callahan. It was like a vacation from Callahan in the fourth
one. And the dike.
This one was like a, okay, now it's well into the 80s, and this is the Callahan movie of the 80s, and here you go.
You know what pissed me off, and somebody else pointed this out to me? Captain Briggs.
Mm-hmm.
In the fourth one.
Yeah.
And he was in the third movie, too.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Except for he was Captain McKay.
You know, I wanted to say that to you, is that Briggs, because I thought it was McKay or something in the third one. But they actually just got the name wrong, or who knows what. They just used the same actor and gave him a different name for no reason.
Yeah, really stupid.
Yeah. Well, it's not a flawless series, but I would say that the first three are good, worth-seeing films. If you're the kind of person that's kind of pretentious about your movie watching, but you'll still enjoy a cop movie.
If you're pretentious about your movie watching, go fuck yourself.
Well, okay, that too. But I mean, like, precious about your time. Like, me, I'm basically waiting to die, so I'm just doing stuff until that happens. And so I don't mind watching the fourth and the fifth
Callahan.
The fourth and the fifth Callahan movies.
You're not creating an ice palace?
I was pretty much certain. Now, that the fifth one was going to not be that great. I think I saw the ending on TV, and it's like, really, a harpoon gun? Okay, hilarious. This is funny, it's campy.
I think harpoon guns came into their own in the 80s, too.
That's true. I mean, it's worthwhile, but but those first three are just honestly, like, I really enjoy those first three movies a lot. And I don't know, I just wish they'd struck when the iron was hot and done a couple more within that period of the 70s.
You know,
and
if you
I still want them to do Eastwood.
He went through a period between them where he did all those shit kicker movies.
Well, he did, and he did The Gauntlet. He kind of did a Callahan movie that wasn't a Callahan movie, right?
That one, yeah. Well,
we should check that out. We'll take a break from
that one. I think you'll appreciate it. It's got a lot.
Well, I've seen it before. You showed it to me before. I like it.
I did.
Yeah, I remember a decent bit about it. Not a lot. I mean, I'd enjoy watching it again in a couple months. But
he's definitely not a Callahan.
No. He's more of an. He's more like. I mean, I think it starts with him being like drunk and stuff. Yeah. But I don't know. It's part of my own weird, twisted fascination with this sort of like romanticized sense of interest with the 50s, 60s, and 70s era of America and the way things were, kind of pre-technology and computers and hokiness and all the crap that kind of has come about. And it's probably just because being a kid in the 80s, all that stuff was what you got exposed to first. Especially up here in, you know, podunk Northern California, it sort of was all kind of behind the times anyway.
Like so those viewers?
Like your history. Yeah, yes, exactly. Mrs. Walker! Captain Walker!
Oh, shit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. That's why I do. That's why I'm the editor-in-chief of the Feudal Podcast, Mark. We've discussed this already.
Because you need to throw in Mad Max
references.
Because
I can throw in a reference to something based on... You can give me any object, and I can probably throw in a movie reference. But Callahan was in The Simpsons once. Not as Callahan, but as McGonagall. As you remember, it was a televised version of that existed in The Simpsons of Callahan. Where little Billy needed to be brave and decided to testify against the mafioso guy. He's like, "Well, little Billy, you think you're going to be brave?" He's like, "I don't know, McGonagall." It's like, "I'll try." He's like, "That's a good little Billy." And then later, the chief's like, "Well, McGonagall, they slit little Billy's throat." And then McGonagall's eating a sandwich and he's like, "Hey, I'm trying to eat here." And he's like, "Don't you even know what's going on, McGonagall?" McGonagall says something to the... I forget what McGonagall says, but it's like... It's like, you know, once you get off my back, and then the police chief's like, "What does that even mean?" And then Homer starts yelling at the screen. He's like, "That means he gets things done." And then Lisa's like, "Sit down, Dad." Yeah. So I mean, everyone knows about McGonagall.
Yes.
So the Deadpool fifth Callahan movie, I liked it a little more than the fourth one. I'd give it 3 stars. Which
how
is
many
the
times do we have to fucking? Oh, are you just getting rid of the whole first?
What? So we've got...
Well, it only matters if you pull it back out again.
Mm-hmm. We got... Well, you're really a disgusting human being.